When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date. Whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
Welcome to another podcast, SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works, S&R Remodeling, and the Axley Law Firm. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. John, before we get to national politics, State Representative Corey Mason has been elected the mayor of Racine by a pretty substantial margin.
Yeah, and we should be full transparency here. You and I talked about it the other day, and we weren't sure, right? I think a lot of people wondered how this race was going to go because Racine is an historic labor, democratic, progressive, pretty progressive town. But they've had a huge amount of Tea Party activity down there. It's in Paul Ryan's district, obviously. And they've got the Foxconn thing playing down there. So there's all sorts of stuff. It's all sorts of churn. And Corey Mason, who is a very progressive Democratic state rep, very closely tied to labor, supported by the Working Families Party, was running against a much more conservative city council member who was clearly pulling in a lot of that new right-wing energy, whatever you want to call that down there. And so people thought the race was going to be very close. As it turned out, Corey Mason won a very solid victory. I mean, a clear-cut victory.
Yeah, other than her district, he won most of the wards.
Yeah, and it was really important because he put together an African-American, Latino, white working class, union, multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition, which is what he wanted to do down there. And frankly, I think you have to look at what Mason accomplished as a very significant victory, because he ran as a progressive and as a labor-tied progressive, emphasizing, again, multiracial, multi-ethnic coalitions. I think it's a big win.
I can always tell by people's reaction last night. You could tell that progressives and Democrats had been starved for a victory. There was a lot of jubilation last night on social media.
I had more than 100 retweets from all over the country on my I sent a tweet out saying that he'd won with a picture of him from the uprising in 2011. It's important to remember that Corey Mason was new to the legislature. The uprising came. He was thrown into the politics of that incredible moment, and he emerged as a very important leader, right? Outspoken, unapologetic in his support of labor, slept on the floor in his office, so he could be there at all times to respond to all the stuff that was going on. He came up, he trained in fire, if you will, right, during the Wisconsin uprising. Now the mayor of one of Wisconsin's major cities. And also, just important to point out, he ran for that mayoralty with literature highlighting his labor endorsements, highlighting the fact that he was backed by the Working Families Party. I mean, he's a guy who emphasized where he was coming from. So there was no mystery in this. Nobody was uncertain about, what the choice was.
And it's interesting because he's replacing a more conservative mayor, John Dickert, with a more business background in the Democratic Party. But let's give John Dickert credit. He's really stepping up in his fight to protect the Great Lakes.
Well, and I also think that this is an important thing to understand. Historically in Racine, the battles were not Republican versus Democrat. They were sort of within the Democratic Party. And what's vital to understand is that Corey Mason will serve as mayor of Racine as somebody who does, certainly tries to work with business. I'm sure he will, and I think he'll probably have some success in that. But that does so from a perspective of making sure that those working class neighborhoods of Racine, that all the communities of Racine, are represented in that, in those efforts to land jobs, in those efforts to expand businesses and things of that nature. So I think it's a subtlety, but having someone like this as the mayor of a major Wisconsin city, able to speak out on, you know, urban issues and what they mean, I do think it is a, it's a step in a very good direction for Wisconsin.
And let us not forget that Racine has the highest unemployment rate in the state of Wisconsin, and has for a very long time.
Been brutalized by deindustrialization. And the one thing to emphasize about that is that Corey Mason comes out of multi-generational, working class, Racine, union membership, union tied. And so this isn't just sort of, you know, some... he didn't just move into Racine a couple of years ago because he wanted to have political opportunity. This is a guy who's hardwired into the town. And I think that's probably why he won, to be honest, right, that at the end of the day, he's somebody that people think will fight for him.
Well, his wife is also a judge in that community, so they have deep ties. Let's talk about things that are a little less edifying. I have to tell you.
Like everything else.
Well, you know, I've been involved in politics, and I know this is kind of, you probably laugh at this, but I was 11, dropping leaflets for former New York Mayor John Lindsay in 1972.
Well, Sly, you doof, right?
What's that?
We're essentially the same age, and I was out dropping McGovern literature.
Right, so...
So, you know, with all due respect, we probably crossed paths.
I guess you won that one. But yeah. The Lindsay campaign didn't exactly take off, but boy, he was an interesting figure. But so I always thought that politics and running for public office was supposed to be a game of addition. It appears as though President Trump doesn't believe that. He believes it's a cage match, and it, for better or worse, he's just going to punch anyone who gets in his way.
Yeah, and you know what? I hate to say this, but we don't know that he's wrong, okay? You and I assume he's wrong. As we assume,
well, he's wrong ethically.
Well, ethically and morally and all that—that's a given. But last year, you know, we assumed he was wrong in how he was doing things, but strategically, he pulled some stuff off.
But he's the president of the United States now.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I don't always really agree with John Meacham's perspective. I think sometimes he is the voice of the corporate elite in this country, but I do respect his research and the fact that he has a great historical understanding of the country.
Pretty good writer.
Yeah, he's a very good writer. Here is John Meacham's assessment of Donald Trump.
I think it's a mindless competitiveness. I think that we've seen it with Secretary Clinton, and we've seen it with President Obama. I don't think he knows how to act out of hope. I think he only knows how to act out of fear. And he only knows how to fight, not to lead. And, you know, I guess at this point it all sounds partisan to some people, but this is a historical observation, right? I've voted for presidents of both parties. And it's a remarkable incapacity to empathize with the people around you and with the people, broadly put. He ran for the job with very little understanding, apparently, of that role. And it does matter.
We just spent...
All right. Fair?
Yeah, totally fair. I mean, in fact, it parallels something I've been saying. You know, when I was out on the book tour for Trumpocalypse, you develop your rap. And you don't start with it usually. You develop it kind of based off what people ask questions about, what people are interested in. And it was clear that while I was writing about people who Trump had appointed and empowered, you had to say something about Trump. And the core thing that I always came back to was Donald Trump has zero political experience. And he has zero governing experience. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have marketing experience. It doesn't mean that he doesn't understand the social media moment we're in. That's a big part of why he's president. But he had zero political, zero governing experience. He doesn't know who to ask questions of, right? He literally doesn't know when he's in trouble who to turn to. And so as a result, he goes with his gut. And his gut get out of this thing by making more noise, fighting harder, you know, punching the person who gives you mild criticism, right? And so that's what you saw yesterday with McCain.
Well, let me play that. You know, I'm a big fan of The Sopranos.
Yeah.
I love Goodfellas. I love, you know, I've never seen the Godfather trilogy, but
which is surreal.
Which is bizarre. Yeah. But nonetheless,
nonetheless, you can talk about it in detailed ways.
I find it fascinating. So this certainly has a remarkable ring to it. Let's put it that way.
You heard what he said yesterday, Senator McCain.
Yeah, well, I hear it, and people have to be careful because at some point I fight back.
Yeah.
You know, I'm being very nice. I'm being very, very nice. But at some point I fight back, and it won't be pretty.
Nothing you do.
And then Nicole Wallace said, nothing you do is pretty.
That's a great line, by the way.
I'm sorry, that sounds like it's out of a mobster movie.
Well, it is. You know, I mean, not that Trump's a mobster. I mean, the mob has standards, right? But
a little more dignity.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think he'd be accepted. But look, Donald Trump is a thuggish figure. He responds to things not in a nuanced or calculating or, you know, targeted way. Now, I happen to think that's part of what helped him to get the Republican nomination and even to the presidency, because I think a lot of Americans are very sick and tired of the suit and tie, perfectly manicured
Paul Ryan.
Politician who says things just within the realm of what is politically correct and what is politically acceptable, but does horrible stuff, right? I mean,
Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan is a picture perfect example. That's so Scott Walker, right?
The Eddie Haskell. They're the Eddie Haskells of politics.
And with all due respect, there's quite a few Democrats who fit that category.
Ron Kind.
Well, and the list gets longer and longer.
Did you want to affirm that one?
On trade issues, Ron Kind has been so. And let me go further.
And deregulating Wall Street.
Right, he's been so fundamentally wrong that he really has put himself, you know, outside of even the mainstream of the Democratic Party by being so wrong on that. But there's a lot of this, folks. So I just think there's a tremendous number of grassroots American voters who are incredibly sick and tired of the person who, you know, is perfectly prepared for the TV hit, right, and fits well within the pundit talk.
Well, let's be fair. I mean, and this is no defense of Trump, but I think there are a lot of people that voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and maybe even in 2012 that thought he was going to try to protect manufacturing jobs. He certainly campaigned that way most of 2008, although you and I both noticed the subtle change there once he got the nomination. But
that subtle.
Right, it wasn't so subtle.
Business Journal to say certain things in the primary.
Yeah, well, what he said, his staff said to the Canadians. Yeah. But let's face it, that was pretty slick. And I think there are a lot of people disappointed. I can't get some of my friends in the Democratic Party to understand that, but the truth is he let a lot of people down.
Yeah, but here's the interesting thing. You know, I think Obama did a lot of good on other stuff, and so it's a more complex legacy. I'm going to give Obama some defense here.
Yeah, not much.
But not too much. But what I'm going to say is that I don't think Obama was the problem there. You know, I think there are a lot of people there was long-term deep concern, and I do think there are some Obama voters who just didn't vote in 2016 because they were disappointed with the whole thing. I expect you to see some of that. I don't think many of them went over and voted for Trump. I think what Trump did was maximize the votes of people who, you know, A, core Republicans, and most of his voters were core Republicans, and B, of an additional grouping of people who were just disgusted with the whole thing.
Well, now, who probably weren't motivated to vote for Mitt Romney in 2012,
yeah,
right?
And so here's where it comes down, though. This is the important thing.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break here, so go ahead.
But just a quick hit. Trump has benefited. This is not, none of this is to defend Trump. None of this is to speak positively about Trump. Rather, just to say he benefited from that, rip it all up, throw the punch, don't don't back off on anything approach. And all he knows about politics is that that worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to see him continue to do that as president, even though it's often absurd, often incredibly irresponsible, because he doesn't know anything about politics. He doesn't know anything about governing. This is all he knows.
All right, we'll take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Jeff's Guitar Clinic is a multifaceted shop offering guitars, amplifiers, and all accessories, guitar lessons for all ages, and instrument repair of the highest quality. Take the scenic drive to beautiful Fort Atkinson and see what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call Jeff's Guitar Clinic today at 920-723-1733. That's Jeff's Guitar Clinic at 920-723-1733. Jeffsguitar.com.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation with us on SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. All right, it's really been a remarkable week. I think you said you had whiplash from the president the other day. This is one of my favorite clips that I've heard all week. This is first Mitch McConnell and then Stephen Bannon.
The goal here is to win elections in November. Back in 2010 and 2012, we nominated several candidates, Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Angle, Todd Akin, Richard Murdoch. They're not in the Senate. And the reason for that was that they were not able to appeal to a broader electorate in the general election. My goal as the leader of the Republican Party in the Senate is to keep us in the majority. The way you do that is not complicated. You have to nominate people who can actually win, because winners make policy and losers go home.
The last couple of days, Mitch has been saying this big thing. Hey, you got to win. You know, winners make policy, losers go home. Hey, Mitch, note to self, Mitch. Big Luther Strange and little Bobby Corker are both going home. These people, Mitch, it's 2-0.
And by the way, that little is LIDD. Okay. And then there's this clip.
We just spent quite a bit of time inside with the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, who has been a friend of mine for a long time, long before my world of politics, early into his world of politics, I think. But we've been friends for a long time. We are probably now, despite what we read, we're probably now, I think, at least as far as I'm concerned, closer than ever before.
Closer than ever before.
Well,
that would be like me standing next to Jim Doyle and say, I've always liked him. We're friends. I feel like I've never been closer to Jim Doyle.
Well, it's true. The last part, probably, if you were standing next to him, you'd be closer than you've ever been
right.
before. But the problem with that is, you remember earlier I was saying that Trump knows nothing about politics?
Uh-huh.
Literally nothing. You know, say, like, early in his political career, right? He's talking about early in McConnell's political career.
When he was the county executive of Jefferson County.
No, lie. Mitch McConnell's political career began. He was in Washington.
Oh, that's right.
In 62.
Right.
He was, or 63. He was there. He was there serving in a liberal Republican's congressional office.
Okay. Well, I guess I was talking about elective office, but nonetheless, yeah, I don't think Donald Trump knows anything about it.
Donald Trump knows nothing about.
Mitch McConnell.
When he says early in his political career, he means sometime in like the 90s, Mitch McConnell came to ask him for money.
Uh-huh.
That's their deep friendship. And McConnell, by the way, knows that, and this is part of Trump's problem. I mean, he's standing next to people who really do. Yeah,
didn't Mitch McConnell look like he had somebody who's sitting in the back seat of a car and gets car sickness?
No, he looks to me like somebody who literally has realized that they're bleeding at a press conference and doesn't want to, like, stop. You know, something horrible is happening.
Their arm's about to fall off.
Something like that. It's just pain. The face looks just like, I can't.
Okay, but so the bottom line is, though, what is Donald Trump up to here? He's clearly encouraging Bannon on one hand, and he's doing this two-step.
Well, there's what you saw, and I was amazed that there were any pundits at all that didn't see that far from Trump saying and McConnell saying nice things to each other, they were literally debating. They were bantering in that press event. It was quite amazing, right? And, you know, when McConnell goes around listing the names of the Republicans who lost, right? Do you understand the memory that takes? I mean, he is committed to his memory. The names of the people that were forced on him by the Tea Party. And it's blood oath stuff. And then Trump is like, well, yeah, some of these are good people. We'll maybe talk with Bannon. You know, they were negotiating in public about that. And McConnell was seeking to teach the President of the United States that here's a list of people that got nominated by the kind of folks you're aligning with. Right? By the folks who say, oh, we got to throw them all out. They all lost. They're not in the Senate. And it's just fascinating because then Trump is sort of like taking some of that in. Well, maybe I'll talk to Bannon a little bit. And do you understand the admission that Trump made in that conversation? That he has an ongoing, apparently quite deep, political relationship with Steve Bannon. Don't think that Steve Bannon, you know, let's just say, anybody who says, oh, yeah, Steve Bannon, he's on the outs. He's out of the White House.
No, he isn't.
Please. He's in the middle, by the way, of the Wisconsin U.S. Senate race.
You know, Leah Vukmir did not talk to him about who she would support as majority leader in the Senate. That she said that conversation didn't even come up.
Oh, come on. Well, then her attempt to head off the Bannon endorsement of this other guy, this Nichols guy, you know, was a total failure. They didn't even get to the serious conversation. Because you'll note that her opponent apparently made the pledge or said enough that he got it. And here's the important thing to recognize about Leah Vukmir. She wanted Bannon. You know, she affirmatively was out there trying to get the support of these folks. And she is still saying in interviews, you know, I don't know, they got to get their act together. She's basically echoing Trump, making a play toward Bannon. And so what we've got here is a situation where you have one candidate, her opponent, who echoes Trump, makes a play for Bannon, and apparently is competent enough to get the Bannon support. And then you have Leah Vukmir echoing Trump, making a play for Bannon, and is not competent enough to get the Bannon support.
Well, I think part of her problem is her record. Let's talk about what has transpired with the Gold Star families and what happened with Niger. Here is Brian Williams. Well, let me play this rap from ABC.
Even in the face of mounting criticism, President Trump today defended his claim that other presidents, including President Obama, did not personally call the grieving families of fallen soldiers. The controversy ignited when President Trump finally broke his silence over the deaths of four American special ops soldiers killed in Niger. He was asked why, nearly 2 weeks after the deadly siege, he had yet to mention them or their families.
I've written them personal letters. They've been sent or they're going out tonight, but they were written during the weekend.
But then he said this.
The traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it.
He tried to walk it back.
President Obama, I think probably did sometimes, and maybe sometimes he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told. All I can do is ask my generals.
But the backlash was immediate. President Obama's attorney general tweeted, "Stop the damn lying. You're the president." An aide to President George W. Bush said he called and or met privately with hundreds, if not thousands, of grieving families. And some Gold Star families going public with their outrage, too. This mom tweeting, "Trump does not speak for me and did not speak for my son. He is an embarrassment."
That worked out well.
Well, the incredible thing is, again, we seem to have a theme developing here. Guy knows nothing about politics, nothing about governing. You didn't have to pay a lot of close attention.
Can you speak up just a little, John, please?
I was going to say, the guy knows nothing about politics. He knows nothing about governing. You didn't have to pay a lot of close attention. If you picked up a newspaper or if you watched something other than Fox News during the Obama presidency, you knew two things. Number one, that Michelle Obama actually made it kind of the focus of her first lady role, you know, working with these folks, working with military families, with Gold Star families, really making it a central part of what she did. And you also knew that Barack Obama, I mean, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night, he was out there welcoming bodies back, you know, I mean, or honoring the dead as they returned. There's so many reports and so many stories about him making the calls. What we know is that he did dozens, perhaps hundreds of calls and meetings and different gatherings without any publicity, that he did not seek the publicity.
Well, including going to Lot 60, which, of course, is the unfortunate addition to Arlington National Cemetery where the veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq are buried. Well, this story actually got worse last night.
The White House confirmed tonight the president has called all four families. Tonight when he called the widow of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, she was in the car near her home near Miami en route to the arrival of her husband's body. She was surrounded by family when she talked to the president on speakerphone, but also in the car, we believe unbeknownst to the president, was her congresswoman, Democrat Frederica Wilson of Florida. Tonight's headline from this is this. The congresswoman says she heard the president say to the widow, a mother of two, 6 months pregnant, quote, he knew what he signed up for. And he reportedly went on to say, but when it happens, it hurts anyway. Here is how the congresswoman expressed that widow's heartache in an interview on CNN a short time ago.
This is a young woman who has two children, who is 6 months pregnant with a third child. She has just lost her husband. She was just told that he cannot have an open casket funeral, which gives her all kinds of nightmares, how his body must look, how his face must look. Hmm. And this is what the President of the United States says to her?
One can only imagine.
So, actually, the Washington Post this morning has it characterized a little worse because there were a couple more words in there. He said, well, this is a tough thing, I think. It isn't just this. It's the remarks about Puerto Rico that the military shouldn't have to deliver food and resources to the people of that island. He actually said that this week. Look, you talk about lack of political experience or lack of governing experience. I could grab somebody at the end of the bar of the Ohio Tavern, drinking in Shank's Corners, and I'm pretty sure they would know this isn't how you behave.
No, it's lack of basic human experience. It's lack of a you know, what's referred to as empathy sometimes, but it's just the basic ability to respond in a humane and decent way when something happens. And Trump has shown that he doesn't have that, but B, he actually relishes his reputation for not being very good at that. It's a fascinating reality. I mean, there are very few people in politics who play this game, but he's not the first. I mean, Berlusconi in Italy was this way. You've had some other players historically around the world.
I'm sure Viktor Yanukovych admires it.
Right? Yeah, who knows, but. You know, the bottom line is that Trump likes to come off as the strong man, as the guy who, I write the rules, I talk the way I want to talk, I do what I want to do, I don't follow procedures, I don't follow, you know, the rules or the expected practices. And that's gotten him a good distance down the track. But I think in this incident, this series of incidents, you know, the combination of his ignorance and apparently his insensitivity, I keep saying this. Everybody thinks there's going to be a day where everybody wakes up at the same time and recognizes what a bad president this is. I don't think that's going to work like that. I think each day a few more people get it. And my sense is that
Well, I think there's a reason the Fox poll that came out yesterday that has the Alabama Senate race tied isn't just about Roy Moore. I think it's I think there's a reaction to Donald Trump as well, even in Alabama. And I'm not saying the Democrats are going to win that seat, but the fact that it's a at least according to that poll, it's a tight race in that state says a lot.
They're competitive, and I think they are competitive for exactly the reasons you say. Although, with all due respect, I do think Roy Moore contributes a bit to that.
Well, that's Donald Trump's candidate.
Now he is.
Glad to see in 2004 he was fighting to keep segregation on the books in that state. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it is. Well, look, I think that I keep saying Democrats ought to be in that Alabama race with everything they've got. They ought to try to win it for two reasons. Number one, they might just win it. Polls suggest possibility. But B, even if they don't, it's a communication to people who are thinking of running. If you take a on a tough race, the party's going to take it seriously.
John Nichols.
The party's failed to do that too often.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliesOffice.com.
SliesOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.